And thank you very much for inviting me today and for giving me that introduction. So, one reason why we are interested in the free will debate and why it's one that's been continuously written about is because I think we normally think that quite important practical questions actually rest on it. So it's very common for free will to be regarded as a prerequisite to moral responsibility. And many of our day-to-day actions, policies, and practices seem premised on the assumption that we can hold one another morally responsible. And we see this in many ways. So at a personal level, we might think about responding to one another with what Strawson calls the reactive attitudes, which are essentially emotional reactions to somebody's good or ill will. They include things like gratitude, resentment, forgiveness, and remorse. And we might also think about various closely related practices, such as apologizing, expressing thanks, blaming, or praising, as well as various restorative or retaliatory practices, such as feeling indebted to repay an act of kindness, or wanting to make amends for some kind of harm you've done, or even wanting to seek revenge. And of course, it's not just in our personal lives, but at a societal level, moral responsibility is often seen as crucially linked to punishments like fines, prison sentences, community service orders, and obviously in some countries, still death sentences. And in workplaces, communities, schools, families, we tend to use all manner of penalties, rewards, exclusions, forfeits, blacklists, prizes, encouragements, rebukes, etc. So I'm going to call this whole collection of actions and practices and policies responsibility entailing practices. And I'm going to address the classic problem, which has received a lot of attention, of what kind of implications determinism might have for these practices. So determinism is basically the thesis that only one future is possible, given the way things were in the past and given the way that the laws of nature are. And I want to say that philosophers and physicists alike tend to disagree about whether or not determinism is true. So I'm not going to be saying anything here about whether determinism is true. I'm just going to be trying to assess the implications of it. We seem to have a bit of a puzzle if determinism rules out moral responsibility. And that puzzle arises because it seems to be at least a serious possibility that determinism might be true, but quite a lot of philosophers think that we can't seriously countenance scrapping all of the practices which seem to be premised on moral responsibility and seem to be quite integrally bound up with our lives, both personally and politically. So, a couple of preliminary points before we go on. I'm going to assume for today's purposes that the kind of freedom that matters for moral responsibility involves the ability to act otherwise than we actually do act. Now, some philosophers, following Harry Frankfurt's famous argument, say that the ability to do otherwise is actually irrelevant to moral responsibility. Some of us are not persuaded by Frankfurt's argument. So for present purposes, I'm just going to take for granted that in some sense, alternatives do matter for moral responsibility, although I will make a few concessions to Frankfurt's argument later on in this talk. I'm also going to say absolutely nothing today about whether indeterminism might threaten free will, or even whether indeterminism is consistent with free will. So whether indeterminism fares any better than determinism is a separate question, which I'm not going to look at today. So if you want to know why I'm not persuaded by Frankfurt or what I want to say about indeterminism and free will, I've got various other papers from that, but they're just a topic for another time. So among those of us who do take alternative possibilities to be important for moral responsibility, there is a disagreement about why alternatives matter, what it means to have an alternative, and whether the relevant kinds of alternatives are ruled out by determinism or not. Traditionally, at least prior to Frankfurt, compatibilists have argued that the freedom to do otherwise than we actually do is compatible with determinism, and so the truth of determinism would not require any serious revision of our responsibility entailing practices. Incompatibilists have traditionally argued that the freedom to do otherwise than one actually does is incompatible with determinism, and so embracing determinism would mean that we would have to possibly accept a serious obligation to revise our responsibility entailing practices in various ways. This debate has tended to either end up with a kind of intractable deadlock or else fall into an unhelpful kind of perspectivism. So either each camp simply begins with assumptions that their opponents don't and can't accept, and neither side can support their position without begging the question at issue against their opponents, or else what we end up concluding is that free will is compatible with determinism if we define it in one way, and incompatible with determinism if we define it another way. But what we're unable to say is exactly how we ought to view it, so we don't get any helpful normative guidance about whether the truth of determinism would require us to make serious revisions to our responsibility entailing practices. So I want to today dig a bit deeper into why this happens, and I want to sketch out an approach to this debate which I hope is going to avoid either of those traps. So I'll first sketch out the basics about the debate about whether determinism rules out the ability to do otherwise, which is going to require me to look at different ways in which we might analyse the ability to do otherwise. And then I'm going to sketch three ways of thinking about what it is that's actually going on in this dispute. So we might divide this dispute into three basic approaches: the rivalry view, the ambiguity view, and the contextual variation view. And I want to show why we tend to end up with something like a deadlock, or else with something like a kind of unhelpful perspectivism on all of these approaches. I then want to sketch out a new way of looking at this, a view which I'm going to call the purpose view. And roughly, this view says that when we try to analyse claims like able to do otherwise, we need to look at the purposes for which we're trying to attribute moral responsibility or freedom in the first place. Roughly, which reading it is we should accept depends on what it is we're actually trying to pin on it. So that's the rough view. I hope to show that this view basically allows us to escape falling into either the kind of immovable deadlock or the kind of normatively unhelpful prescriptivism. So traditionally, disputes about whether the ability to do otherwise are compatible with determinism have centred on questions about basically what kind of analysis we should give to phrases like able to do otherwise. At the broadest level, we might ask whether the ability to do otherwise should be understood according to what I will call an actualist or a non-actualist analysis. The former is variably called an all-in, all things considered, or categorical ability. So on an actualist analysis, what matters when we ask whether an agent is able to do otherwise in the free will dispute is whether the agent is able to do otherwise as things actually stand, holding the past and the laws of nature constant. I take it to be fairly obvious that if this is the way we're defining the ability to do otherwise, then it's going to be very difficult to reconcile the ability to do otherwise with determinism. So recall, determinism I basically just defined as the view that no alternatives are possible, holding fixed the past and the laws of nature. So it seems to follow quite obviously from this view that if we take that analysis seriously, then determinism rules out the ability to do otherwise. In contrast to that, on a non-actualist analysis, ability claims are assessed without holding fixed the past and the laws of nature. Rather, an agent's abilities will depend, at least in part, on the way things could have been in certain hypothetical situations. So this might involve various departures from the way the actual past was or the way the actual laws of nature are. Now, there's not much scope for variation on the actualist reading, but there's quite a lot of variation in terms of non-actualist readings. There's lots of different kinds of non-actualist analysis we might endorse. So these include various forms of traditional counterfactual analysis and might also include dispositional analyses, and in some respect also what we might call an emergentist analysis, as well as various more complex variations on these themes. While proponents of an actualist analysis will only accept that an agent is able to do otherwise if she could have done otherwise as things actually were, proponents of non-actualist analyses take a range of alternative scenarios to be relevant to assessing any agent's abilities. On a counterfactual analysis, we might want to know, for instance, whether the agent could have acted differently had her prior choices or motivations been different in some way. On a dispositional analysis, we might want to know, very roughly, whether an agent could have acted differently if the dispositional triggers in her environment had been different in some way. And on an emergentist analysis, while we might embrace actualist conditions at the level of agency, we will reject those conditions at the physical level, at the level of physical realisers. So roughly, we might want to know whether the agent could have acted differently if they had very similar mental states or agency level states, but if they had been realised in some kind of different way physically. So those are some examples of some ways we might think that departing from the actual reality of the past and the laws is relevant to assessing ability claims. For present purposes, the differences between these different kinds of non-actualist account needn't detain us. So I'm going to just refer to the non-actualist analysis in a way that just means you can substitute it for whichever kind of analysis is your favourite. But the contrast I'm going to be really interested today is the contrast in general between something like an actualist analysis and one or any of these different non-actualist ones. So it's generally agreed that if an actualist analysis is right, then determinism rules out the ability to do otherwise. And it's generally agreed that if a non-actualist analysis is right, then determinism need not rule out the ability to do otherwise. The difficult bit then is working out which of these analyses is the right one. However, in asking which of these analyses is right and which of these analyses is wrong, we're already presupposing that these should be understood as rival theories. And that's one way we might look at it, but it isn't the only way, and it's certainly not an uncontested assumption. So both compatibilists and incompatibilists have often regarded these different accounts of able to do otherwise as rival analyses, and this is the view which I'm going to call the rivalry view. On this view, what we want to know is precisely which of the analyses is the correct one. At the very least, we might be asking which of these analyses is the right one or the relevant one for settling questions about moral responsibility and free will. Potential answers are then going to be regarded as mutually inconsistent with each other, so we have to choose. Van Inwagen is especially explicit about this commitment, but other philosophers do seem to be committed to this way of viewing the dispute too. Proponents of this approach often see one of these analyses as legitimate, while suspecting the other analyses to be in some way fraudulent or spurious. So Van Inwagen claims that the compatibilist's non-actualist move is, and I quote, contrived and ad hoc. It's engineered to achieve the compatibility of free will and determinism. Similarly, O'Connor supposes that the non-actualist reading of the ability to do otherwise is, in the sense of tissue, no ability at all. Meanwhile, on the other side of the debate, Smart accuses the incompatibilist favoured actualist reading of involving a special sense of the ability to do otherwise, And he objects that it is the ordinary sense that we use when we talk about moral responsibility. The implication here being that the incompatibilist reading is a term of art, irrelevant to what we ordinarily or commonly mean when we actually use these phrases. So basically, incompatibilists have, throughout a lot of history, tended to view the non-actualist analysis as what Kant called a wretched subterfuge, or what James called a quagmire of avoidance, while compatibilists have tended to think of the incompatibilist favoured analysis as an irrelevant philosophical abstraction, perhaps something which even does violence to common sense or to ordinary language in some way. So on the incompatibilist's favoured actualist reading, if determinism is true, then we're unable to do anything other than what we actually do. Compatibilists tend to note that we don't know whether or not determinism is true, and yet we do know that every day we basically very liberally attribute unexercised abilities to ourselves and to other people all of the time. I might not have actually made a cup of tea yesterday, but we wouldn't normally say that I was therefore incapable of making a cup of tea yesterday. Incompatibilists typically concede that we might retain skills even when we're not exercising them, but they suppose that what matters for moral responsibility is not whether we have these kind of skills, but whether we could have actually exercised the skills in the relevant circumstances. So we might all agree that the lifeguard is a good swimmer and had the skill required to save the child, but before we blame her for failing to do so, we might also want to verify that she could have actually exercised the skill in the circumstances. If she'd been restrained or drugged or something like that, we would say that she's not responsible for failing to save the child, even if there's an abstract sense in which she had the ability to do it. So, of course, there is then a further dispute about what it would mean for an agent to have a realistic opportunity to exercise their abilities understood in this sense. Does that involve it being possible as things actually stand? Or is it enough that the agent could have done it if, for instance, their prior motivations or their environment had been a bit different in some way? So this also seems to then give rise to a debate about whether we should accept an actualist or a non-actualist reading. The compatibilist points out that in everyday life, we often blame or praise people for things that they do deliberately or willingly, and we typically absolve people of responsibility or refrain from blaming or praising them for things that they did by accident or they did against their will. These distinctions are quite well captured by thinking about whether an agent's actions are responsive to her values and her choices. This responsiveness, in turn, looks like it can be captured by thinking about whether the agent would have acted otherwise had her choices or values been slightly different in some way. In contrast, the incompatibilist often supposes that there are further questions about fairness here, which the compatibilist account essentially misses. Even if the agent did the wrong thing deliberately, we might wonder whether she could reasonably have been expected to do anything better in the circumstances. It would be unfair to blame her or to praise her for something that she actually just could not have avoided doing, given the way things really were, even if she could have avoided doing it in slightly different circumstances. After all, she had to decide in the circumstances that she actually faced, with the character and motivations that she actually had, not in slightly different circumstances in which we alter these things a bit. Now, one problem I want to say with the rivalry view is that I think we can be prompted, even in relation to a single instance of wrongdoing, to basically think in both of these two different ways. So I think we can think that different analyses are relevant depending on why we're holding the agent responsible and depending on other circumstances of the other features of the circumstances and the context. So consider an example which is adapted slightly from a real life case. Suppose that Ben is normally a very warm and caring person. He's a good husband and father for the most part, and he's generally kind to others and mindful about the interests of other people. But there is one general exception to this rule. Unfortunately, Ben suffers bouts of depression, and sometimes when he's going through a bout of depression, this causes him to drink heavily, and when he drinks excessively when depressed, he can become quite abusive. Unfortunately, Ben has recently suffered a bereavement and been made redundant, causing a depressive spiral, and this has caused drinking binges in which he's gotten into fights in bars, as well as shouting and smashing things during rows with his wife, which has become intolerable for her and really quite frightening for their small children. And because of this, his wife has insisted that they need a period of separation. And to that end, he's been sent to go and stay with some family members abroad for a while to try to clear his head. Unfortunately, this leads to Ben being alone and unsupervised in an airport waiting for his flight. And as if things weren't bad enough, he's now worried that his marriage is breaking down and that he might be losing access to his children. So his already quite vulnerable mental state is quickly spiralling. He is also surrounded by bars and duty-free outlets. Predictably, he drinks heavily before the flight and then gets into an altercation with cabin crew who refuse to serve him more alcohol. And this leads him to punching a member of staff, shouting at fellow passengers and trying to open a door mid-flight. He is restrained for the remainder of the flight and arrested upon landing. Now, suppose that when Ben's family come to collect him, he doesn't show as much contrition as they might have hoped. He views this as an unlucky, isolated incident rather than recognising it as part of a pattern of problematic behaviour. His family at this point might talk to him in a way that suggests that they want to hold him morally responsible. So they may say things like, "Look, you need to start taking responsibility for your own behaviour, Ben. It's your own choices that got you into this mess. You know how you get when you're drunk and when you're depressed. You should have just avoided drinking. If you'd just chosen to stay sober, this whole situation wouldn't have happened. You have to accept this situation as your responsibility." So that's kind of plausibly the sort of thing they might say to him. And in this case, it might seem as if they're assessing his ability by thinking about what he would have done if he had had slightly different prior motivations or made slightly different choices. So it might appear that a kind of non-actualist analysis looks like the one they're invoking here, and the one which might appear most salient to Ben's moral responsibility. Nonetheless, suppose that his family are quite taken aback when they find out from his lawyers that he's actually likely to get a 2-year jail sentence for this. In this case, they might well object that the problem is he just can't help it. It's true that none of this would have happened if he'd chosen earlier not to drink and exercised a bit more restraint, but those who know him know that it's also true that when he's in the wrong sort of emotional state and he's under a particular kind of strain and in a vulnerable state of mind and he's placed into the wrong kind of environment, there's a sense in which he's just not able to resist drinking in that situation with all of the inevitable and unfortunate consequences. So in this case, it might seem as if now they're invoking a different idea of moral responsibility. They're saying that actually, given his actual situation, given his actual motivations, once we hold all of this fixed, there's a sense in which he just couldn't realistically have done otherwise at all. And in this case, it looks like they're invoking something much closer to the actualist analysis. So when they're trying to get him to acknowledge his role in events, they're trying to get him to develop greater self-awareness, perhaps to commit to doing better in future and to take responsibility in that sense, they're likely to put more weight on his ability to do otherwise in a non-actualist sense. In contrast, they might emphasise different things when they're trying to assess whether he genuinely deserves something like a 2-year prison sentence. In this case, they're likely to maybe shy away from the non-actualist interpretation and put more weight on his apparent inability to do otherwise, given all of the facts about his state of mind and the environment that he was basically facing at the time of his misdemeanours. Now, Ben's example, it should be noted, doesn't always cut neatly across compatibilist and incompatibilist lines. In particular, I think there's quite a lot of compatibilist analyses, according to which we're also going to say that maybe Ben couldn't do otherwise and that he isn't morally responsible. The problem, however, the problem that interests me at least today, is that I don't think we're just unsure about whether we should count Ben responsible or not count him responsible. In fact, I think we're genuinely ambivalent about his responsibility. Different factors seem salient to his abilities in different sorts of context, where different kinds of repercussions are dependent on it. Whichever side we come down on, it seems to me that the rivalry view might be too restrictive to actually capture our ordinary breadth of thinking about moral responsibility. So we might often think that both readings give us a responsibility-relevant sense in which we sometimes think that agents are able to do otherwise. And given that we are generally inclined, I think, to think in both of these different ways, it seems to me that we can't easily maintain that uniquely one reading is relevant here, and it seems unlikely that either side will be able to persuade the other side that their reading is basically fraudulent or spurious or irrelevant. And in fact, it doesn't seem to me that we should accept that either of these readings is entirely irrelevant to moral responsibility and free will. So, if we don't like the kind of rivalry picture, a natural response to this kind of problem might be to posit some kind of ambiguity. According to the ambiguity view, terms like free or able to do otherwise are ambiguous between two or more readings. Lots of different philosophers have suggested some kind of ambiguity like this, and very often the difference corresponds to a difference between broadly actualist and non-actualist readings. Positing an ambiguity in this way can be a method of doing justice to the fact that both readings sometimes appear to be relevant and neither one seems to be outright fraudulent. So the ambiguity view might seem to offer us quite an obvious compromise. The problem with this approach is that it doesn't really help us to get any kind of tangible normative guidance. So suppose that you're the judge presiding over Ben's trial and you're wondering whether he really could have done otherwise and hence whether he's responsible and whether he really deserves the 2-year sentence you're thinking of giving him. It looks like on the ambiguity view, what we're going to say is something like, well, if you're using the term able to do otherwise in one way, he deserves the sentence. And if you're using the term able to do otherwise in another way, he kind of doesn't deserve the sentence. So it just sort of depends how you're using the terms. Now, I'm going to say, if you're the judge, that much is obvious to you. The question you're puzzling over and the question that you're interested in is which analysis you ought to be using. So it seems like if we just posit an ambiguity, then we don't really get the kind of actual practical, tangible, normative guidance which we might hope an account of freedom is going to help us with. So while on the ambiguity view, words like free and able to do otherwise might have more than one legitimate reading, on the contextual variation view, these terms might mean one thing, but they might nonetheless vary in terms of what they pick out when it comes to different conversational contexts or different contexts of utterance. So at least since Crapter's proposed contextualist semantics for terms like can, philosophers have supposed that ability claims might be indexed to particular contexts of utterance. David Lewis famously proposed an analysis of can quite similar to Crapter's when he was talking about abilities in relation to time travel paradoxes. And Lewis also defended a kind of contextualism that looks quite similar to this in the realm of epistemology. Curiously, however, David Lewis did not seem to appeal to any kind of contextualist analysis like this, when he was discussing whether determinism rules out the ability to do otherwise, in his famous dispute about this with Van Inwagen, he seems to accept something much more like the rivalry view and accept that the non-actualist reading is probably the one that we ordinarily use or the one that we should regard as relevant. Nonetheless, other philosophers, such as Hawthorne, have been quite directly inspired by Lewis's kind of contextualism in relation to knowledge to propose a very similar kind of analysis of able to do otherwise. So epistemic contextualists try to argue that knowledge and claims to knowledge might vary depending on context. Epistemic contextualists concede that we can only claim to know something once we've removed all of the salient sources of doubt. And in everyday contexts, we can often properly ignore certain sources of doubt which aren't salient. But whether a source of doubt counts as salient and therefore counts as something we have to take into consideration might vary from one context to another. So ordinarily, if somebody asks me whether I know what time the train is coming in, I might have to rule out certain sources of doubt. I might have to check that the timetable hasn't changed since I last checked, or that there isn't a delay happening. But there are other sources of doubt which, in this everyday context, I wouldn't be expected to rule out, such as doubt about whether I'm a brain in a vat and whether trains exist at all, because I might be systematically deluded by an evil demon or something like that. In contrast, if I was in an epistemology seminar, I might well be required to pay attention to doubts of this nature. Problem is that once we start paying attention to a source of doubt, it becomes salient to us in the context. So by drawing our attention to these possibilities, the skeptic is basically able to raise the bar so that we then have to meet a higher standard before we can take ourselves as knowing anything. Now, there are some striking parallels between the epistemic skeptic and the incompatibilist here. Suppose I say of my disorganised friend, who's often late, she could have tried a little bit harder to get here on time. There are certain things you might expect me to pay attention to here, like whether someone detained her against her will, or whether she had to deal with a medical emergency, or something like that. But I can normally ignore the question of whether her choices were rendered inevitable by the laws of nature and the starting conditions of the universe. Nonetheless, in a philosophy seminar, I might not be permitted to completely ignore factors like this. So, like the epistemic skeptic, the incompatibilist raises the standards by drawing our attention to further facts. Once we attend to the fact that our friend's choices might have been inevitably entailed by events prior to her birth, we can no longer properly ignore it, and we're forced to accept a more restrictive picture of what we can say she's able to do. In philosophical debates, when we're contemplating skeptical challenges, we generally need to meet these higher standards than we do in ordinary contexts. Now, the epistemic skeptic takes all of the sources of doubt to be relevant to our knowledge descriptions, whereas non-skeptics think that some sources of doubt can always be taken to be irrelevant. Likewise, the incompatibilist takes all of the facts to date to be relevant to our ability descriptions, while the compatibilist considers some of the facts to date to be irrelevant. The contextualist, in both cases, argues that the context of utterance might determine which range of factors are relevant and how high the relevant standards are. Now, at first sight, this approach seems like it might appear to supply a bit more normative guidance than the ambiguity view does, since it opens up the possibility that features of the context of utterance might warrant or call for a certain reading, rather than this just being fixed by the arbitrary intentions of the person speaking. But that impression turns out to be mistaken. The problem is that the context of utterance alone often seems like quite a dubious basis on which to settle this. Returning to Ben's unfortunate incident on the aeroplane, it seems true that we might be inclined to describe him as able to do otherwise in contexts where we focus on certain facts, such as the fact that his actions are generally responsive to his choices. or the fact that had he chosen not to drink, he could have avoided his later misbehaviour. And yet we might be inclined to describe him as unable to do otherwise in contexts where we focus on different facts. Facts about the fact that when he's placed in a certain environment and under certain sorts of emotional pressure, he can't possibly choose not to drink, and therefore his kind of later misbehaviour or the unfortunate consequences of his drinking were rendered sort of inevitable and something he kind of fell into. But it seems implausible that whether he deserves a 2-year sentence or not is something we would expect to shift depending what we're assessing his responsibility happen to be paying attention to in the context. An agent's responsibility seems to plausibly rest on certain factors, which we might think it basically objectively rests on. Factors usually everyone agrees relating to such things as their frame of mind, their motivational states, the pressures of their situation, etc. Since the contextualist typically supposes it's the context of utterance of the person making the assessment that matters, it seems to tether the responsibility of the agent to basically our subjective judgments and what we happen to be focusing on or paying attention to, rather than what we might think of as objective facts about the agent's circumstances and state of mind. And it seems that this is not the kind of thing we want their responsibility to be dependent on. So those features only become salient to us or to our conversational context when we happen to be paying attention to them. But the problem is they seem equally salient to whether the agent deserves a sentence or not, whether we're paying attention to them or not. So what we don't want is for it to just depend on who happens to be looking at these factors and what they happen to be paying attention to. Now, the epistemic contextualist aims to retain a protected sphere of knowledge where doubts that would otherwise be salient can be ignored exactly when we're not paying any attention to them. But this strategy risks introducing what I think is a wildly implausible kind of relativism when we introduce a parallel move in relation to moral responsibility. Whether or not an agent deserves a certain punishment doesn't look like the kind of thing which we think should shift depending on what the person assessing to it happens to be paying attention to. Now, a compelling solution to this problem is proposed by Anne Whittle, who I think has one of the most well-worked-out versions of a contextualist account of ability. She says we need to draw a distinction between attributing responsibility and holding responsible. And she supposes that when we're merely making claims about whether an agent is responsible, when we're choosing whether to describe them as responsible, this is something that might vary with the context of utterance. But what the contextualist analysis can't determine, on her view, is what we're actually permitted to do by way of holding an agent responsible. We can suppose that responsibility attributions depend on context and vary from one context to another without endorsing a corresponding contextual variation with respect of what we're morally justified in doing on the basis of these attributions. Now, this approach seems to me to be correct, but it's our justification for actions which have to be tethered to something morally non-arbitrary. That's why we can't tolerate relativizing those to the subjective states of the person making an assessment. In contrast, if we focus just on our reasons for describing someone as responsible or free in a completely normatively neutral way where absolutely nothing practical rests on it, then there's no corresponding problem about tethering this to something which is morally arbitrary but seems relevant to our conversational setting. However, on this model, our responsibility ascriptions turn out to have almost no bearing on the question that I'm interested in today, which is the practical question of whether we need to revise our practices or what we're actually practically justified in doing by way of holding agents responsible and how we should understand the kind of freedom relevant to justifying our practices. So our responsibility ascriptions might shift depending on what we're paying attention to, but to resolve the practical problem which I want to address, it seems like we need to know something else, which is what ought we be paying attention to when we make assessments about an agent's responsibility? What things should we be taking into account or looking at? So this is the question I think that we want to resolve, and this practical question, it seems, can't be resolved on this kind of contextualist analysis. So the purpose view. Like the contextual variation view, the purpose view allows the appropriate reading of able to do otherwise to be relativized to different circumstances. But unlike the contextual variation view, the appropriate reading has to be relativized to objective features of the circumstance and not to the conversational focus or the intentions or what we're paying attention to in relation to the person who's actually making the assessment. So whether or not a person counts as able to do otherwise is not going to shift just depending on what we happen to pay attention to or which reading we happen to arbitrarily select. Rather, it's going to shift depending on the goals or the purposes for which we're holding the agent morally responsible. So we're going to have to analyse freedom differently, on my view, depending on what we're practically trying to pin on our responsibility attribution. And this is something I want to say we can evaluate by asking four questions. One, what is the goal of holding the agent responsible? Two, are we permitted to pursue this goal at all? Three, does the practice effectively serve this goal? And it's in relation to three that I think we can start to see which reading of able to is relevant in each instance. And four, are the costs imposed by the practice justifiable for the sake of the goal? So let's consider these questions in turn. Firstly, why do we hold agents morally responsible? What is the actual goal of our responsibility practices? Problem here is that philosophers have emphasised at least six different categories of purposes for the sake of which we tend to hold agents responsible. So retributive purposes involve aiming to basically inflict deserved punishment. That involves inflicting suffering on a wrongdoer in proportion to their guilt, where this is just an end in itself. The proportionate suffering of the wrongdoer on this account is seen as an intrinsic good, something worth bringing about regardless of whether it serves any other purpose at all. Improvement purposes might include trying to encourage, deter, rehabilitate, improve public sensitivity to moral demands, repair relationships, or foster trust in law enforcement processes, or foster respect for the law. Communicative purposes involve signalling disapproval of wrongful actions or communicating solidarity with victims or perhaps just telegraphing a standard of right behaviour or accepted values. Duty allocating purposes include aiming to hold parties to reasonable terms of agreements or to basically allocate who has to bear costs and liabilities in a way that people can reasonably accept when these have to fall somewhere. Engagement purposes involve aiming to treat someone as a person or to foster a certain kind of deep interpersonal engagement, perhaps trying to avoid treating them in a way which seems impersonal or alienating or involves a problematic kind of objectivity. And expressive purposes involve venting our feelings just for the sake of release, rather than for communication or for influence, such as, for instance, aiming to satisfy urges for vengeance or aiming to express one's gratitude simply because repressing those feelings is stifling or perhaps feels inauthentic in some way. The problem is that we might engage in responsibility-entailing practices for all of these reasons or for some of these reasons, and any particular course of action, whether it's sentencing someone to prison or saying thank you or holding a grudge, could be done for several of these purposes. Moreover, some practices might, in some circumstances, effectively further some of these goals while hindering other of these goals. Compatibilists and incompatibilists often take different purposes to be more fundamental. both sides are prone to sometimes assuming a monolithic picture of moral responsibility, and hence assuming that the sorts of abilities that underscore moral responsibility have to basically be equally relevant to all of our responsibility-entailing practices, justifying all of them wholesale. But that assumption could just be groundless. Given the different purposes for the sake of which we hold one another responsible, we might have reason to suppose that the relevant reading of able to differs from one instance to another. So the next question here is, are we actually permitted to pursue all of these goals? Are these goals we're actually allowed to pursue in the first place? So I believe that none of these goals is inherently impermissible to pursue. The most controversial categories here are retributive purposes and expressive purposes. If we punish purely for retributive purposes, we seek to bring about suffering when, and importantly only when, the agent genuinely deserves it in such a way as to make that suffering count as an intrinsic good. Now, I think almost by definition, it can't possibly be morally forbidden to aim to bring about something that's an intrinsic good. So if retributive practices look morally dubious, I think it's because we're sceptical about whether anyone actually has the kind of desert required for their suffering to count as an intrinsic good. In this case, the problem is that not that we're barred morally from pursuing retributive goals, but that actually we think that none of our practices are really effectively serving this goal. That is, none of our practices are bringing about an intrinsic good such that they're inflicting suffering which is deserved and which ought to be an end in its own right. In this case, the problem isn't that we're prohibited from pursuing the goal, but that the practices are ineffective at achieving it. So we're going to get to that in our third question here, but that doesn't mean that it's ruled out on the basis of the second question here. So expressive purposes, I think, can also seem troubling. If you punish someone for no purpose other than to satisfy your feelings of vengeance, say, this often looks like it's going to be morally unconscionable. But again, I don't think the problem is necessarily with the goal itself. If we imagine the costs imposed are quite serious, then often these goals are going to look too frivolous to be worth it for the costs. But this is a separate problem, which brings us to the realm of the fourth question here, whereas at the moment we're just finding out whether it's morally wrong to pursue this as a goal at all. Now, of course, if you punch someone in the face just so that you have a sense of relief or something, release or something like that, this is going to look bad. But the goal of releasing otherwise oppressive feelings isn't inherently bad. It might be perfectly okay to scream into a pillow out of earshot to exactly the same end. So what seems to be going on in this place is that the costs are just disproportionate for the sake of the value of the goal you're trying to pursue. So inherently, I don't think any of the other goals are likely to be ones that people would object to or think that we're not allowed to pursue in the first place. But I think all of these goals are ones we're allowed to pursue. So if we have problems with our practices, it has to be on the basis of our other questions. So let's consider the third question here. Does the practice actually effectively serve the goal? It's here that I think we can begin to see how an examination of the purposes of our practices might supply the relevant reading of able to do otherwise. So certain practices are rendered useless for certain purposes if agents do not have abilities understood in a particular kind of way. So consider practices that we engage in for improvement purposes, such as influencing, educating, improving moral sensibilities, deterring unwanted behaviours and the like. Holding someone responsible for improvement purposes often makes perfect sense, even if they cannot do otherwise, in the incompatibilists' favoured actualist sense, so long as they can do otherwise in various weaker non-actualist senses of the sort typically emphasised by compatibilists. If a penalty is going to deter someone, what matters is that their actions are generally responsive to their motivations and that their motivations are generally responsive to incentives and disincentives. we needn't worry about whether they could have had different motivations in light of all of the facts today. So it looks like determinism just poses no threat to the kind of ability to do otherwise that's relevant for trying to pursue these kind of influencing and improvement purposes. But now consider holding responsible for purely retributive purposes. Free will skeptics often focus precisely on practices with this aim. So Galen Strawson goes as far as to say that the kind of freedom we're interested in is the kind that would make sense of the fact that it could be justified, and this is a quote, to punish someone with eternal torment in hell or reward them with eternal bliss in heaven. Now, this seems quite extreme, but the afterlife is presumably invoked to ensure that there couldn't be any goal or end served by inflicting the suffering other than the fact that it's deserved. And we often see that it's this kind of retributive goal that is the focus of a lot of people who are sceptical about free will. So this is the kind of goal which is often emphasised by people like Per Boom and Caruso, for instance. But I want to say that actually it turns out many compatibilists are equally sceptical about whether we can punish for these purely retributive goals. Lots of people we think of as classic compatibilists like Hobbes, Dennett and Smart are, for instance, fairly explicit about rejecting punishment purely for these kinds of purposes. Moreover, a great many compatibilists who explicitly describe themselves as retributivists actually barely mention punishing for wholly retributive purposes. So Strawsonian retributivists often focus almost solely on engagement purposes, while others focus almost solely on improvement or communicative purposes. And for still others, the goals might not be made all that explicit, but it's often not obvious that the end goal is just retribution. Now, sometimes this is complicated by the fact that some compatibilists appear to endorse what we might call a self-effacing theory, whereby retributivism is endorsed not as an end in itself, but as a way of achieving some other ultimate end, which we might not effectively achieve if we aimed at it directly. So in those cases, the end goal might be to improve our sensibility to moral demands or something like that. And the idea is that pretending that we're doing it for the sake of retribution is just an effective way of achieving one of these other goals, but ultimately it isn't the end goal. So Kant is sometimes regarded as both a retributivist in this strong sense and as a compatibilist. But in fact, I think it's wrong to regard him as a compatibilist. In fact, I think there are some problems with regarding him as straightforwardly a retributivist, but that's more controversial, so I'm going to put that to one side. So sometimes people describe Kant's view by saying that he accepts that determinism is true in the world of appearances or something like this, but that it's false in some kind of transcendental realm. But actually, that's just a way of saying that for Kant, determinism seems to be true, but it isn't really. He thinks that the transcendental arguments give us reason to doubt what we might think if we were just looking at empirical evidence. So it's also obviously true that he explicitly rejected the non-actualist readings of his day. As I mentioned earlier, he described them as a wretched subterfuge. So I certainly don't think that Kant is going to count as a compatibilist in this sense. In contrast, Michael Moore was one philosopher I could find who I think does plausibly appear to be both a compatibilist and also a retributivist in this strong sense. He's someone who supposes that weaker compatibilist analyses might be sufficient for agents to deserve punishment, precisely in the sense that's required for their suffering to basically count as an intrinsic good if it's proportionate to their wrongdoing, and where this ought to be pursued just as an end in its own right. But it turns out that this is actually much more of a minority position than we often suppose. And I think that there are quite good reasons why this turned out to be more of a minority position than we would usually think. So incompatibilists argue that this kind of desert, at a minimum, requires that we could reasonably have expected the agent to avoid wrongdoing in the circumstances. it doesn't seem enough if we're going to blame them in the sense that that involves regarding their suffering as an intrinsic good, that they could have avoided the wrongdoing in different circumstances had they had slightly different motivations or something like that. Now, the compatibilist retributivist might argue that the agent, as long as the agent intended the wrongdoing and the agent was acting thoroughly in character when they intended the wrongdoing, this should be enough. They're not acting out of character, they did it deliberately, it's exactly what they wanted to do. But we might think that basically there are at least two quite different moral considerations which seem to be at work here. So one consideration is whether the agent's action is a true reflection of the kind of person she is, whether it's a reflection of her true self or something like that. The other separate consideration is whether she had a reasonable chance to avoid wrongdoing. And these concerns seem to me to be distinct. If an agent's actions depend on her choices, and her choices depend on her values, then this might be quite a good indication that her action is a good reflection of who she is as a person. And this might be well captured by various non-actualist analyses as well as various sourced analyses which don't appeal to alternatives at all. If we changed her values or her decisions, would her actions have been different too? But we might also think that it matters that the agent had some realistic ability to avoid wrongdoing and to avoid it as things actually were. And ordinarily, we tend to often assume that throughout our life, we get some say in the kind of character we develop, and that perhaps if we're bad people, we had some opportunity to avoid becoming bad people earlier or something like that. We often find it quite difficult to accept that an agent essentially just deserves to suffer for her wrongdoing if we find out that she couldn't help becoming the kind of person she is or having the kind of character she does. So, for instance, if we learn that her character flaws were shaped by an unfortunate upbringing or other circumstances that turn out to be completely outside of her control. So even if her actions are a true reflection of her character, it seems unfair to regard her suffering as an end in itself if she had no realistic ability to either develop a better character or to act differently or make better choices in light of the character she actually had in the circumstances she actually faced. If she's acting deliberately and in character, there might, however, be plenty of other purposes for the sake of which it's still worth punishing her. But regarding her suffering as an intrinsic good, worth pursuing even if absolutely no other end would be served by it, seems to me to be overly harsh if she's got absolutely no realistic possibility of avoiding wrongdoing. So one of the reasons I think free will might often look intractable and paradoxical is because different abilities are relevant for different purposes. So practically, we might have six free will problems here rather than just one. It seems that agents must be able to do otherwise, I want to say at least, in the actualist stronger sense, in order to justify holding them responsible for purely retributive purposes, when absolutely no other end is served by it except bringing about deserved suffering. In contrast, it seems to me that when it comes to holding agents responsible for the other goals here, the weaker non-actualist ability to do otherwise suffices. And in fact, at least for expressive and engagement purposes, I think it might often be true that no ability to do otherwise is required at all. So I'm willing to concede to followers of Frankfurt that at least for some of these purposes, we might be doubtful about whether the ability to do otherwise even matters. So finally, even when a practice does effectively serve some purpose, there are obviously always limits to what we might do, justifiably do in the service of any particular goal. And this brings us to the final question. Are the costs of the practice justifiable for the sake of the goal? Now, as noted earlier, one reason why expressive purposes might often look morally dubious is because in many cases, the goal seems too trivial to justify the kinds of costs imposed. Similarly, when it comes to improvement goals, We might think that even if some deterrent is highly effective, it would be unjustifiable because the costs imposed would be excessive. So perhaps we could really effectively stop students from stealing library books by introducing public hangings for library book theft. That would be a really effective way of pursuing the goal, but clearly we would think that relative to the importance of the goal, the costs imposed are very excessive. And in this case, we might think that that's one way in which a practice could turn out to be morally wrong. So what are the implications of accepting this kind of framework? First, I want to say that we needn't be forced to accept that one analysis of able to do otherwise is always right, and the other analysis is always wrong. But nor are we forced to accept the kind of perspectivism whereby an agent's responsibility might shift depending on which reading we arbitrarily choose to adopt or depending on what we happen to pay attention to, where this is going to rob us of any ability to give practical normative guidance when it comes to justifying any particular policy, action, or practice. On this view, the relevant analysis depends on the purposes served by our practices. We can settle questions about which purposes we're permitted to pursue and what we're permitted to do for the sake of those purposes, the same way that we normally settle these sorts of questions, by appeal to some theory of normative ethics. Moreover, if we're not relativists about normative ethics, we can also eliminate related sorts of relativism about moral responsibility and about what we're permitted to do by way of holding agents morally responsible. And this means we can take much of the free will dispute out of the realm of abstract metaphysics and into the realm of moral philosophy and the ordinary questions which we usually ask in moral philosophy. So, relatedly, I maintain that we usually approach this debate the wrong way around. What we do is we assume that the starting question is, what is free will? How do we define free will? How do we define the relevant kind of ability to do otherwise? And we assume that with this as our starting point, we can then proceed on to questions about whether our responsibility entailing practices are justified. If we're not free, according to our preferred definition, then all of our responsibility entailing practices are going to need some revision. And if we are free, according to our favoured definition, then none of them are going to need revising. The approach I recommend begins with the question of what we're actually trying to pin on our responsibility ascriptions. It then suggests that we have to determine which analysis of freedom is relevant with reference to the purposes for which we're holding agents responsible. This has the further implication that we need not assume that a single analysis is going to be equally relevant to justifying all of our diverse responsibility entailing practices. Different practices might be premised on different kinds of freedom, depending on the purposes for which we're engaging in them. And of course, different analyses might be relevant, and therefore different practices might be threatened by determinism or not threatened by determinism, depending on the analysis that's relevant for the purposes of our practices. So there may be no single and independently ascertainable notion of free will upon which all of our responsibility entailing practices hinge. Rather, it might be that our practices serve different purposes. These might be premised on different sorts of abilities, and hence determinism might undermine our justification for some of our practices while leaving others completely intact. Finally, I think this gives us a way of making inroads to the apparent stalemate about whether determinism rules out the relevant kind of freedom or the relevant kind of ability to do otherwise. Even if you're not persuaded by my analysis of which reading of the ability claims is relevant to which of these goals, I hope that the framework might at least give us a way to clarify what's actually in dispute and ensure that both sides are actually talking about the same thing. And we needn't suppose then that the gap between compatibilists and incompatibilists is just an intractable deadlock, that it's a gap that can't be bridged through philosophical dialogue. Thank you.